Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll learn more about the bus driver shortage from someone who is behind the wheel. Decades ago, two communities battled over a major meatpacking facility. What's happened in both towns since? We'll also revisit the series Big Ag U. Corporate ag money is gone to colleges and universities. It can create some sticky situations. A longtime lobbyist is finally calling it quits and reflects on his career. And we'll hear from a man who lost his partner in the 80s during the AIDS epidemic. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Schools across the country have been dealing with a school bus driver shortage all year, and some districts even started paying parents affected by it. Peter Medlin rode along in a school bus in Rockford to hear about how the shortage is affecting drivers and students.
Get these wheels rolling.
It's early on Monday morning, and bus number 430 is pulling out en route to pick up kids and drop them off at Riverdale Elementary. Amber Shellern is behind the wheel, even though before this year, she wasn't typically a bus driver. She's a supervisor in the transportation department. Her day job is helping kids who miss their bus and fielding phone calls from parents. But because of the driver shortage, Shellhorn, along with administrators and even some mechanics, are driving every morning before they start their other jobs.
How many more drivers could they hire before you'd be like, okay, I feel pretty good about this. We're like in an okay place.
20.
20 more?
Yeah. And that would just to be able to breathe.
Today, around 20 drivers called in sick, a few with COVID. Sometimes upward of 40 people call off, and that makes it impossible to cover every bus route. The district tries to cycle through which routes go uncovered, so it's not the same students being affected every day. Early in the year, 1,400 students would be left without a ride at some point in the school week. Shellern says it's getting better, but on this day, there were still 22 routes where students had to find their own ride. Our route is an easy one. Only about a dozen elementary school kids, mostly half asleep. Other buses are much more packed with COVID rules relaxed. This month, our route has only been left uncovered once. But the shortage affects kids in other ways too. But before we get to that, bus dispatch has some news from the transportation center.
Oh, we got an accident, see?
There's been an accident with one of the buses. Everyone appears to be fine.
The other vehicle, that driver was injured?
No.
Please send those two children to her bus and send her on her way.
So that was our fault then. So our bus hit somebody.
Because of that accident, students on that route are going to be 25 minutes late for school.
So now all those kids are standing there. So now imagine if we're having school and it's wintertime. Or even if it was raining right now,
yeah.
They're standing there.
Back to how the shortage impacts students. Amber's day job includes picking up students and taking them to school in situations like this. But because she's driving a bus and there's nobody to supervise, those kids are late for school. Our route, on the other hand, is running smoothly. We're picking up our first kids now. Parents are hugging their kids and seeing them off to school.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Where's your mask?
Good morning.
You don't have a mask either.
On top of the travel logistics aspect of bus driving, Shellern also understands that her job is about the kids. She knows that what she says to them matters and tries to be a positive presence.
We don't know what their home life is like. We don't know if there's love, food, stability, structure.
She keeps that spirit while also maintaining some semblance of order on her bus. Only once on our trip does she have to take charge.
What's the problem in the back of my bus? Please stop. I'm riding you up.
A few minutes later, around 7:10 in the morning, we pull into Riverdale Elementary. Shellern parks the bus, and then she makes her way to the back row to chat with that student. She hears about what's been bothering him, talks him down, and relinquishes the write-up. Finally, it's time to head into the school. Shellern opens the door, and the kids and their bright jackets and Spider-Man backpacks file out. Shellern says it's not a bad job with the hours off during the day and new bonuses and benefits put in place because of the shortage. In the meantime, they're waiting to exhale as they try to make the wheels on the bus go round and round for as many students as they can. I'm Peter Medlin.
A lobbyist who has spent nearly half a century at the Illinois State House, retired, Caroline Kobzanski spoke with Randy Witter as he was cleaning out his office to hear about his time under the Capitol Dome.
Randy Witter picked up my phone call from a snowstorm of papers. Over 48 years in the State House while working on everything from the Clean Indoor Air Act to the recent Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, Witter's amassed a lot of hard copies. He's kept the preference for print, even as the legislature has moved toward pixels. Witter's not convinced that the pivot to paperless and remote lawmaking is an upgrade.
I use the analogy of watching baseball over the television or going to the stadium and watching baseball. And while watching over the television, you can get very, very specific and you can see the batters and the catchers and the pitchers pretty much up close, but you don't have the feeling of the grandeur of the stadium as a whole.
One consequence of that is a faster pace of legislating. Now that lawmakers can file proposals and amendments with a few clicks, Witter says the pace of business under the dome has become almost frenetic. He's not sure this is a good thing either.
While I think it's good that we have this kind of technology, there are occasions when it really needs to simmer. A particular idea needs a little bit more time before the vote is cast.
Witter fell into lobbying as a law student when a former professor asked him to follow some lobbyists for a day and report back on what they were doing. Soon after that, he switched from law to public administration studies at what's now the University of Illinois Springfield. There, he met his future business partner, Bob Cook. After a stint with the Illinois Association of Realtors, Cook and Witter formed their lobbying firm in 1985. Witter is aware of the public perception of lobbyists, which he describes as
little pot-bellied men sneaking around the back hallways, wearing their pinky rings, chomping on a cigar, and carrying big bags of money.
Witter says the lobbyist's real role in this process is a lot less sensational.
A lobbyist is really a communication link between a particular interest, be it a union, an association, a corporation, an association, and the lawmaking process.
Over years of participating in that process, Witter has also watched the shape of Springfield itself change as more and more of the state offices and workers were moved to Chicago.
When I came to Springfield in 1973, there were still many, many agencies that had either their headquarters or a major operation in Springfield, as well as the Chicago or the suburbs of Cook County. Today, a number of agencies have pretty much moved lock, stock, and barrel to the Chicagoland area.
Witter has seen problems that take the work of generations to even get a dent in them. Campaign finance is one of those.
There's been a lot of legislation and now laws in regards to the disclosure of who's giving money to whom and how much money is being given and are there limitations on those monies.
Despite the flurry of sunshine laws and calls for transparency, he says the recent federal-level legal decisions have probably made the path an even steeper one than it was.
The Supreme Court ruling on 501c4 organizations not having to disclose who has given money to the political action committee of a 501c4 has thrown a monkey wrench in the whole thing. That whole process is very, very hard to address.
Witter also thinks trust in government has declined during his career, which spanned the 1974 impeachment effort that led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon, and more recently the ongoing federal investigation of former House Speaker Michael Madigan.
There's more cynicism and probably more suspicion of government because of some of the sensational allegations that have been made, as well as some of the actual facts that have come out.
That said, he thinks the suspicion isn't entirely a bad thing.
There's a degree of willingness to challenge things. New ideas are good.
And while Witter sees things that need challenging in Illinois, he thinks the legislature will be part of the solution. And he'll be watching, albeit from a different perspective, for the first time in decades. I'm Caroline Kobzanski.
Four decades ago, two cities, Garden City, Kansas, and Lamar, Colorado, competed for the world's largest meatpacking plant, and for the winner, it meant becoming the epicenter of the region's beef industry. For the other, it meant a continued economic slide, all too familiar in rural America. As David Kondos reports, that fateful outcome has forever altered trajectories of both towns.
Larry Jones lives in a farmhouse just outside Garden City, surrounded by rows of Milo. But even out here on the sparsely populated Great Plains, he runs into traffic jams.
The lights coming on the highway is about 5:30. So when the first shift starts coming in, it's line of cars and line of trucks.
Why? His farm and cattle company sit next door to one of the country's largest meatpacking plants, Tyson Foods' Finney County Beef Plant. With over 3,000 employees, the sprawling slaughterhouse butchers more than 6,000 head of cattle every day. Jones, who's also a county commissioner, says having the plant here cut trucking costs for local livestock owners and supercharged the local economy.
Driving through Garden City, it's changed immensely. If you'd been here 20 years ago and looked at it, you wouldn't recognize the town.
More jobs, an influx of immigrants, a growing town in a region that has lost population for generations. This meatpacking plant's arrival in 1980 marked a turning point for Garden City, making it the fastest growing part of Kansas almost overnight. But the decision to build it here also changed the fate of another town, Lamar, Colorado. That's because Lamar was the runner-up in the contest to land the plant decades ago. In the 1960s and 70s, the number of water wells drilled into the Ogallala Aquifer under western Kansas skyrocketed. It created an ecosystem. The aquifer waters the corn feeds the cows drive the meat packers.
Although many processing plants are located near metropolitan areas of consumption, there is a growing trend to locate plants in areas of supply.
As this film from Union Pacific Railroad points out, meatpacking plants historically operated in urban centers, Kansas City, Chicago. But in the 1960s, packers began to build plants in the countryside, away from big city unions and closer to cattle.
Today, a pound of meat travels an average of 1,000 miles from the open plains to the kitchen range.
Don Stull tracked the meatpacking industry's impact on Garden City for more than 3 decades as a University of Kansas professor, and he cataloged it in his book, Slaughterhouse Blues.
Garden City was more or less the first of what became these boom towns tied to food processing. It was largely a white agrarian community in 1980. And within 5 years, Garden City grew by 1/3.
Its rapid growth also brought change the town still wrestles with today. Housing shortages, strains on healthcare, education, social services. And since many of the plant workers were and are immigrants and refugees, it would remake the town in a way that worried some white residents. But local leaders bet big on the plant to secure the community's future economy. And by many measures, it worked. The beef industry now pumps around $2 billion into the county's economy each year, and the city has parlayed that growth into becoming the region's retail hub. It boasts the only Target store for more than 200 miles. So what would Garden City look like today without meatpacking?
Well, look at Lamar.
Lamar, Colorado sits 100 miles west of Garden City. The towns share the same river, the same highway, the same railroad line, and the same Dust Bowl past. And through the 1960s, they had roughly the same number of residents. But Garden City's population has just about doubled since 1970. It's now over 28,000. Lamar's remained stuck, around 7,500. While Garden City gained another 1,500 people in the latest census, Lamar lost more than 100 residents. Russ Baldwin takes a left turn off of Lamar's Main Street.
And behold, the former Burger King, home of the ex-Whopper.
Plywood boards cover the drive-thru window. KFC left town too. Within minutes, he drives past the old Kmart, vacant. The airport? It lost its last commercial flight more than a decade ago. Baldwin moved to Lamar the same year the plant opened in Garden City and now runs the town's weekly newspaper. He says the last 15 years have been particularly tough.
Okay, you're sitting there going, you know, what's next, the locust invasion?
It wasn't always this way. Stephanie Gonzalez heads the Regional Economic Development Organization. She grew up in Lamar in the 1980s.
I remember seeing buses running east and west, north and south. I remember having a lot of people up and down Main Street. That's what we need to get back to.
Those buses brought in workers for the town's bus factory, which employed roughly 600 people at its peak. But that factory laid off its last 300 workers in 2006. Including Gonzalez's parents. 15 years later, she says the town is still searching for new employers that can make up for all those lost jobs, But there's a perception that Lamar doesn't have enough workers to make it worthwhile to do business here. It's a vicious cycle that's repeated across rural America. Having fewer jobs and businesses makes it hard for towns to attract and retain residents. Having fewer residents makes it hard for towns to get new jobs and businesses. Meanwhile, Garden City's growth makes it even more difficult for nearby towns like Lamar to compete. Gonzalez says Lamar residents often drive over an hour to shop in Garden City. That speeds the demise of businesses in Lamar.
The development that we're seeing with Garden City and the growth that they've experienced could have really benefited Lamar and the surrounding areas, you know, had there been maybe some different mentality at the time.
That mentality? A fear of change. Some people in Lamar worried about bringing in immigrant and refugee workers.
We should have welcomed the diverse numbers of people that would have been employed at a facility like that.
County Commissioner Wendy Buxton Andrade says that outlook kept Lamar from pushing harder to get the meatpacking plant. Even though she says the town is more welcoming now, changing that mindset has been a decades-long struggle. And people in Lamar still talk about what might have been.
40 years later, hindsight's always 20/20, and I think it's a shame. I think we missed a huge opportunity.
Back at the Tyson plant in western Kansas, a steady stream of trucks carry cattle in and meat out. Even after four decades of growth, beef still directly or indirectly drives nearly all of Garden City's industries. Here's Kansas Professor Don Stull again.
If the Tyson plant were to close tomorrow, Garden City would be in a world of hurt.
Within decades, much of the underground aquifer that fuels the beef ecosystem around Garden City will run dry. And that could send big plants like this one packing in search of more reliable water sources. So even with Garden City's recent prosperity, Stull says it's likely just a matter of time before this boomtown goes bust.
Ultimately, unless something can be done to turn that trend around, western Kansas will look like eastern Colorado.
In Garden City, Kansas, I'm David Kondos.
We have more to come on Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It's common these days to see big corporate names plastered across university campuses, especially within agriculture departments. Whether it's a building, an endowed teaching job, or a research center, corporations and public universities are increasingly cozy. Reporting by Harvest Public Media and Investigate Midwest reveals just how much money has gone to Midwestern universities and how that money can put schools in some sticky situations. Dana Cronin talked with Sky Chatty and Jonathan Hedinger from Investigate Midwest.
So first, let's lay out our top findings here. Sky, how much money have corporations given to Midwest schools over the past 10 years?
At least $170 million, Dana. But that's very likely an undercount because we were only able to obtain data from four public universities. Some states have public records laws that shield donor information. But out of these four, the most of the money went to the University of Illinois at $100 million from corporations. Second place was Iowa State University with $50 million.
This series focuses in part on the potentially thorny situations universities put themselves in when they accept these corporate gifts. Jonathan, you looked at a specific case from 2018 involving the University of Illinois and Monsanto. What happened there?
Well, Dana, for years, the University of Illinois courted Monsanto. The company gave more than $3 million to the university to sponsor research and gifts in other areas. So in 2018, when a weed killer called dicamba was causing widespread damage to crops, and a University of Illinois professor spoke up about the damage, one top Monsanto official felt he could speak up about it. Rob Fraley, the chief technology officer, contacted the agriculture dean, calling the professor biased and prone to exaggeration. But the dean defended the professor, but it was still an awkward moment for the university with one of their biggest donors.
Yeah, I want to acknowledge, too, that sometimes corporate influence on universities isn't quite that obvious. Here's a clip from someone we talked to for the series. This is Gabrielle McNally with American Farmland Trust.
Corporate influence has that kind of
it's this much more tacit sort of control over the research agenda. And so it's a way for people to say, like, well, they're not controlling us. They're not like, they're not our puppet masters. But it's much more sort of, in a certain way, I think, like, it's so in the water that you're like, yeah, but we only research the crops that they're heavily investing in.
Sky, why do universities need this money? Why not avoid putting themselves in these sticky situations?
Federal and state funding to public universities has stagnated in the past couple decades. And at the same time, the federal government used to be the largest funder of R&D in agriculture. The private sector has now taken over as that dominant funder. And what we heard when we talked to university officials was that courting this money is a way for universities to remain relevant. Here is Daniel Robeson, the dean of the Agricultural College at Iowa State University.
It's funding that helps keep us relevant with respect to pragmatic needs that are on the ground. And there are many, many organizations, companies that are doing fundamental research as well. And so our ability to work with them and their interest in working with us speaks to, I think it speaks largely to our relevancy, frankly, to the industry that helps to support the production of food.
Other school officials we've talked to have said that this money helps universities continue to do the kind of research they need to do in perpetuity.
Yeah, we heard that from Bruce Sherrick. He's a professor of farmland economics at the University of Illinois and heads a research center that was funded by the corporate investment giant TIAA.
Every university should look for the ability to build, my opinion, freestanding, unrestricted gifts to fund things that they want to do on a permanent basis.
That's Dana Cronin speaking with Sky Chatty and Jonathan Hettinger about their series Big Ag U. It looks at corporate influence at public universities across the Midwest. And why are schools so eager to take that money? It's becoming harder to get tax dollars to fix up ag schools at public universities, and even harder to find public money to build new facilities. But as the farming industry steps in, there are growing ties between agribusiness and college campuses. Katie Pikus and Seth Bodine report.
The heavy hum of construction equipment reflects millions spent to build a feed mill tower in Ames, Iowa. The project promises a working feed mill and ways to use that in both research and training. It'll crank out about 20,000 tons of feed a year, and it costs $24 million to build. But Iowa State University and taxpayers aren't paying a dime. Private donors are picking up the tab, notably agribusinesses. Charles Herberg is an Iowa State University agricultural engineering professor. He says the facility will run like a business and hopefully draw more students to milling.
And that's one of the target areas that we want to meet, is to be able to help those people get onboarded into companies and even existing staff of companies, bringing them up to speed with new technologies.
This privately funded facility fits with a trend. Ag schools at public universities increasingly pull in money from industry and other private sources as legislatures grow less willing to chip in tax dollars. The practice builds stronger relationships with the farm-related industries where many of the school's graduates will want to work. But critics worry those ties could turn work at universities that puts industry needs above a broader public interest. Emma Schmidt is with Food and Water Watch.
And just in general, agribusiness as it stands right now is, you know, it's not about the small farmer. It's not about rural communities across Iowa. It's about Wall Street. It's about making a profit.
State tax dollars to Iowa State decreased 19% in the last dozen years. Funding from agribusinesses makes big projects like the feed mill possible. Ray Klein is the director of the Office of Partnerships for the Ag College.
I consider it critical, and I consider it in some ways a reinforcement of the relationship that we have in place with all of our industry partners.
For other states like Oklahoma, where funding has been cut more than 30% between 2008 and 2018, money from private donors is a necessity. Michael Leachman is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He tracks trends in state policy.
Even going into the pandemic, funding still remained well below pre-Great Recession levels in most states. And in many states, the funding cuts were severe.
Agriculture departments across 97 universities have an $11.5 billion backlog in repairs. And many researchers are stuck with older, crumbling labs. Peter Reeves collected data for the study. He says that money has gone toward new buildings over investing in old ones.
And so then what we ultimately are left with is this situation where, you know, we have aging out infrastructure that has been underinvested in for years, and the cost of waiting is starting to catch up with these campuses.
Some researchers at Oklahoma State University work in outdated buildings that haven't been upgraded, and that affects their research. Plant and soil sciences professor Brett Carver spends his time breeding wheat inside greenhouses that were built in the 1950s. He says it's like...
we're trying to race or perform in an Indy 500 in 2021 with a car that would have been manufactured in the 50s. We can do things. We can soup up that car to maybe try to keep up, but we're going to eventually pay the price for that.
And they did pay the price. When a winter storm hit, the greenhouses got too cold. Carver says that could put him up to a year behind on his research. University officials say Carver's greenhouses are on the list of funding priorities. They're soliciting private and corporate sponsors to raise roughly $15 million to build new ones. And for Iowa State's feed mill, the Ag College plans to seek out state, federal, and private funds for research. Wherever universities get their funds, trends show they'll continue to look for money from agribusiness. Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
In 2013, the largest farmland asset manager in the world made a $5 million gift to the University of Illinois to establish a research center. Dana Cronin reports on how that center was funded to study the very area of investment where the company has few rivals and has wandered into controversy.
You probably know TIAA as a manager of retirement accounts. It's a huge player in that market.
In over 100 years, we've never missed a payment. Guaranteed monthly income for life.
And part of that giant investment portfolio is farmland. Because as it turns out, farmland is a really good investment. It's stable and tends to increase in value year to year. And as the saying goes, they're not making any more of it. So farmland is increasingly viewed as a commodity, something to be bought, sold, or rented. And the TIAA Center for Farmland Research, housed at the University of Illinois, is evidence of that. The $5 million donation that made the think tank possible is the fourth largest corporate gift the university's agriculture department has received in the last 10 years. That's according to data obtained by Harvest Public Media and Investigate Midwest through the Freedom of Information Act. Bruce Sherrick is a professor of farmland economics and the center's director.
When people ask me what I do, I say I'm interested in anything that affects farmland values. Anything that affects farmland values. Who does that matter to? Anyone who cares about farmland values.
He says that's not just the center's benefactor.
That's farmers, that's investors, that's input dealers, that's crop insurance people.
But some say focusing on farmland as just a commodity puts investors over the communities that rely on the land. Gabrielle McNally leads an initiative at American Farmland Trust that supports women landowners. She says corporate investment in farmland drives up the cost of the land, and that can make it harder for new people to own farmland.
And it is by and large women and folks of color who kind of make up this sort of the new and beginning farmer group.
Research also shows that conservation often falls by the wayside on plots of farmland owned by corporations. TIAA has also come under fire for working with a land grabber to acquire some of their Brazilian farmland. That's led some of TIAA's own clients to speak out, like University of Iowa anthropology professor Laura Graham. Her research focuses on indigenous communities in Brazil. Her retirement account, managed by TIAA.
And so it's very ironic that my own retirement is supporting something that my research and my work with communities is in direct opposition to.
So she and other University of Iowa faculty demanded transparency and accountability from the investment giant. TIAA declined comment for this story. Sherrick, head of the TIAA Center for Farmland Research back at the University of Illinois, says that controversy hadn't surfaced yet when the university received the gift. But he says that no-strings-attached corporate gift created a model for universities to dedicate themselves to research in perpetuity.
State funding had gone away. Federal funding had gone away. Our extension program finances have gone virtually completely away. So we're substituting for those other sources.
Others say this corporate model leaves out rural communities that schools also need to serve.
You know, we need to be looking at farm policies which would strengthen small-scale farmers and make land more accessible to them.
Doug Hertzler is a senior policy analyst with ActionAid USA.
People that have a worldview that playing the market is what matters aren't thinking about the well-being of those rural communities.
Hertzler says creating more of these corporate university research partnerships could ultimately hurt those whose livelihoods depend on farmland, farmers. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
That story part of Big Ag U, an investigative series by Harvest Public Media and Investigate Midwest on corporate influence at public universities across the Midwest. Well, early in the pandemic, we checked in on a few businesses in downtown Macomb to find out how they were managing. Dylan Smith recently followed up with the owners of a couple of those businesses to tell us how they've kept the doors open.
Illinois banned indoor gatherings in mid-March of last year. That was just a few months after Craig and Julia Burns had taken ownership of the wine cellars in downtown Macomb. Some people called it bad luck for the couple. Because of the ban on gatherings, the wine cellars could no longer bring in crowds with trivia nights, sip and paint evenings, or live music. The front doorbell would not ring like it used to. The wine cellars relied only on retail as curbside delivery became a primary source for business. The Burns say that's what kept the business going because the community had their back.
We wouldn't still be here without the support of the community, and they really rallied behind us and many of the small businesses, and we are just so grateful.
You know, if there are silver linings to this, that is one of them, is that, you know, it really forced some of these small communities to focus on their local businesses.
This year, even as the state eased some COVID-related restrictions, the Burns came up with new ways to bring in customers while keeping them safe. The addition of the backdoor beer garden allowed them to host live music outside, and Julia Burns says that continued to draw crowds well into fall.
We're doing things that we never would have thought to do before. I think the outdoor atmosphere has been the biggest thing. Our people really have decided they like to be outside.
Recently, the wine cellars hosted Play It Forward, a full day of live music that raised money for the McDonough County Humane Society. All musicians played for free as the event raised more than $2,000. Just next door, Sullivan Taylor Coffee House also experienced a change in ownership, but it happened while the pandemic was already well underway. Brandon Thompson, who worked under former owner Dan Lewis, took over the business in June of 2020. That was the same month that the business celebrated its 25th anniversary. Thompson used the downtime during the state's ban on indoor gatherings to renovate the business. Just one of the many ways that Thompson made the most from a bad situation. Thompson says he has his employees to thank the most for getting the doors back open.
I don't think I'd slept for something like 40 hours the day before we had opened, and one of my employees literally said, go home, take a nap. It's like, I gotta finish this, and he's like, no, we got it, right? So, like, the employees really stepped up and, like, have helped me realize that, like, this pandemic is not all that bad.
More than a year later and with a revamped look, Sullivan Taylor Coffee House is back to the everyday business grind. And while all seems well, Thompson says one of the biggest struggles he's had since reopening is enforcing COVID-19 guidelines. He says the coffee shop follows health department guidelines, which has cost him some business.
I made a decision that we are going to strictly follow it, and I've had so many customers leave because of it.
For now, Thompson continues to make steady improvements to Sullivan Taylor with regular maintenance and concocting new menu ideas. And he says the shop is doing well since reopening last July. Thompson says the whole experience has made the business stronger.
I believe we've really kind of gained a new plan, a new idea on how to, like, carve out our stake in this community. We really try very, very hard to take care of our customers. And that's every business, but we try really hard to take care of our customers. I put a huge emphasis on taking care of my employees and to get higher quality employees, put them through training to understand the full works of coffee.
Both Sullivan Taylor Coffee House and the wine cellars praised the community for being the backbone of their livelihood during a rough time. Both businesses were forced to make drastic changes when the pandemic began, but the community was right there to support them. I'm Dylan Smith.
You're listening to Statewide. Stay right here. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 2021 marked the 40th anniversary of the first documented case in the U.S. of what would go on to be called AIDS. Our reporter Maureen McKinney examined the early years of the epidemic and what happened since, part of our ongoing series, AIDS at 40. She talked with the Danville native, Arlen Miller, who told the story of how he lost his partner, Mike Walsh, more than three decades ago.
I went to learn how to be an AIDS buddy, and my partner, Mike, happened to be at the training the same day I was, and we met during a break and started dating pretty quickly thereafter. He was one of the smartest guys that I ever knew. He had a killer combination of devastating blue eyes, good looks, and a great sense of humor, and was just really very personable. He went to Georgetown as an undergrad and got a degree in international finance, and then he went to law school at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He had a lot of offers from a lot of high-powered law firms to make a lot of money, and he decided that he didn't want to do that, and he wanted to go into civil rights law. In retrospect, I think he was at that AIDS buddy training looking for a partner who would take care of him, and so he found him. The biggest thing was, you know, how could I continue the relationship with him and stay safe myself? And the answer to that was yes. So we just kind of went for it, and we were together, I want to say, 2.5 years before he died. We had a few dates, and actually in bed one morning and kind of have sex, and then he proceeded to lecture me about how I needed to be more careful, and then told me that one of the reasons I needed to be more careful was because he was HIV positive. The funny thing about Mike was that right up until 6 months before he died, he never had anything to me that was more than an inconvenience. So he was on an experimental AIDS treatment, and he got onto that protocol because they were conducting the study. And primarily he did that because he didn't have medical insurance, and that was a way for him, one, to get on a protocol with a drug that might be life-saving, and two, to have regular medical care. And then in August of 1990, he started having a lot of headaches all the time. And long story short, it turned out to be an AIDS-related brain tumor. So he, from August to early November, so it was really only a couple of months from the time he really got sick until he died. I think that that all of his symptoms and the brain tumor were related to the trial drug that he was on. One night I was out with a friend, and he called me and he was like, please come home. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm trying to talk and I can't say what I want to say. And he was kind of like he was locked inside of his body. He had no control over his speech functions, and that lasted for a few weeks. He got quickly worse and worse, but I was still trying to work and keep everything together because, you know, at the time we met, he didn't have a job. And I had a really busy job, traveling a lot. I had a very supportive boss who knew the whole story. And most of the people that I worked with, everybody was pretty supportive through that whole period. But there were times when it was just a little overwhelming. He ended up going into the hospital at NIH. That was when I kind of told his sister-in-law, it's like, you need to tell his family if they ever want to see him again and see the person that they knew, they need to come now. You know, everybody kind of got to see him while he was still with it. And then he was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. And one day I went to visit him and the nurse took me aside and said, okay, well, it's time for Mike to go home. And I'm like, why? And she's like, well, there's nothing else we can do for him here. I had thought throughout the course of our relationship about the fact that Mike was eventually going to die. But then it was like really right in my face, like, oh, what am I supposed to do about this? And then they just kind of took us through the Cliff Notes version of how to help someone die. And that included, you know, saying, well, you know, he's obviously never going to get better. So when he starts getting really sick, then it's all about comfort measures. And that's all you care about is just keeping him comfortable until he dies. So they loaded me up with like a bag of cotton swabs that had lemon and glycerin to swab his mouth out with. And then they gave me liquid morphine and kind of gave me the Cliff Notes on how to use that. He eventually went into a coma while he was at our house, and we had moved him from our bedroom into a sun porch and kind of set up like a hospital room in there. We had a hospital bed, and there was like a nonstop stream of his friends coming to see him while he was still lucid. And then it got to the point where he lapsed into a coma. And so for like, I want to say it was like 2.5 weeks, all we listened to every day was his rasping breath. And it was just like 24 hours a day. When he would make noises and we thought maybe he was uncomfortable, then we would go to his bedside and administer some liquid morphine. The last week, I was sleeping on a little wicker sofa next to Mike's bed, and I fell asleep. And what woke me up was the absence of the rasping breath, and it was like the room was silent. I walked over to his bedside, and he had stopped breathing. And so I put my hand on his chest and said his name. And then there was like all of a sudden this huge intake of breath. And that was it. Went to the door of Carl's bedroom and knocked on the door and said, "Carl, can you come up here?" You know, I let him know that Mike had died, and he's like, "Okay, I'm gonna go get my mom and dad, because I want my mom to be able to hug him while he's still warm." And his mom and dad came and said their goodbyes, and then we called the coroner, and then I watched them take him out of the house in a body bag, and that was it. What we learned was you save the drugs and give the drugs to somebody who can use them. And so as it happened, a lot of my friends were dying at the same time Mike died. And I want to say it was like maybe not even a week after he died, another friend of ours called, who his partner had been a lobbyist, and he and Mike had been really good friends. And Nick was his partner, and he called me up and he's like, "Well, I'm pretty sure Jim is going to die any day now, and I don't know what to do." And so I gathered up all my liquid morphine and my cotton swabs that NIH had given me. And I was like, "Well, I'll be over and I'll give you the Cliff Notes that they gave me." And then just a couple of days later, Jim died. So it was just probably for a space of like 2 months, it was nonstop. I think I lost like 5 or 6. One really exceptionally close friend died probably just a few days before Mike. And then a rapid succession, like all I did was go to memorial services probably for about a month. I remember the year after Mike died, I sent a Christmas card to a friend of his who had been very helpful. And I got a letter back from his brother who said, "Hey, got your Christmas card. Sorry to tell you that Rick has died." And he was an engineer at NASA. I was thinking about this the other day because they have all the white flags symbolizing all the people who died of COVID. Well, during the 1992 March on Washington, and they unrolled the National AIDS quilt, it went from the Washington Monument to the Capitol. Mike just really symbolized, you know, the waste of a whole generation of gay men left. And, you know, the rest of us just had to pick up the pieces.
That's Danville native Arlen Miller. He lost his partner, Mike Walsh, more than three decades ago, and he told his story as part of our ongoing series, AIDS at 40, marking the anniversary of the first documented AIDS case in the U.S. A lawsuit filed in federal court over delayed bail hearings of Black Lives Matter protesters in Winnebago County has been fully briefed and is currently under advisement. Now the wait is on for a panel of judges from the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals that heard the case to draft an opinion. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco has details.
Over the summer of 2020, the plaintiffs in the case were arrested on a Friday evening and detained until bond court on Monday, the next regular business day. Adele Nicholas, the attorney representing the plaintiff, said her clients were held for well over 48 hours without being brought in front of a judge.
It's notable that Winnebago County's procedures are really an outlier, both in Illinois and around the nation. In most jurisdictions, a person who is arrested by a police officer has an opportunity to be brought before a judge within 24 to 48 hours.
So the way it works in Winnebago County, if you're arrested on a Friday, you do not see a judge until you've sat in jail for three nights, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday night. And then you don't see the judge until Monday afternoon, when they have regular bond court. Nicholas says court schedules look different even just a couple counties east.
In Cook County, it's completely different. If you are arrested on a Friday, you see a judge Saturday morning, and that judge will determine both whether there was probable cause to detain and whether you're entitled to release on bail.
But in Winnebago County, the defendants in this case, the county and its own court system, are arguing that this practice is constitutional because the judge is still making a probable cause determination within 48 hours, despite the detained person never actually appearing before the judge. The plaintiff's argument is that the Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable pretrial detention, and that the procedures observed in Winnebago County are simply insufficiently respectful of that right. Pam Metzger is a professor of law at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, whose work deals with early-stage criminal procedure, and says that a delay in initial appearance can dramatically affect the lives of detained individuals.
Think about all the things that are on your calendar for today, for tonight, for tomorrow. If you have an elderly parent you care for, or a child, and think about what would happen if you just disappeared for a minute. Now imagine that disappearance stretching on for an hour, for two, for 24 hours, 48, 72 hours. Just the fact of an arrest and a booking has catastrophic consequences for people and their families.
Metzger adds that an initial appearance should offer an opportunity for the arrested person not only to learn about their rights, but to have the opportunity to exercise them. That means that a judge or magistrate explains to that person all the protections that the Constitution provides in a setting where the person who's been accused has a chance to exercise those rights. But in Winnebago County, if you're arrested on a Friday evening, you may not get that chance, at least not within 48 hours.
When they set up their court calendar, the court administrator is making a decision that looking at probable cause determinations and saying, yep, there was a good reason for this person's arrest, is important enough that a judge should have to do that over the weekend. But apparently, speaking to someone who's been arrested, telling them about their rights, helping them get a lawyer, helping them get out of jail and back to their families, is not important enough to make someone come into court on a weekend and sit on the bench and do their job.
Seven of the eight plaintiffs were released on what's called an I bond, which is an individual recognizance bond. So there was no controversy about whether they were entitled to release on bail. It was that they didn't even have the opportunity to ask for 3 days. Nicholas says that the question now is whether the Fourth Amendment protects the right to be brought in front of a judge for a bail hearing within 48 hours of arrest. The appeals court panel heard the case last week and is now drafting an opinion. Nicholas says there's no set timeline.
I've seen it happen as quickly as a week or as long as a year after the case is argued. So it's a little unpredictable how quickly we'll have a decision.
Until then, the plaintiffs, once again, will have to wait. I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
That's all we have for Statewide for 2021, and we thank you for joining us and hope you'll be with us in the new year as well. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find all of our episodes at our website at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide, and our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.